Greetings, friends, and welcome to another hour of wonderful entertainment as we gather again around the old Potter Radio. I'm your host, Corey Walker. February 2nd is Groundhog Day, the day we find out whether or not spring is near. Groundhog Day has its origins in Pennsylvania Dutch folklore and was first celebrated on February 2nd, 1887 in Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania. I did some digging and managed to find a single Groundhog Day themed radio program on the web. Minnesota School of the Air was an educational program run by the University of Minnesota during the 1940s and 50s on KUOM, the university's public radio station. There were five subseries that ran as part of the School of the Air, including tales old and new, which consisted of, quote, highly entertaining fairy tales. In celebration of Groundhog Day, I am bringing you the February 1st, 1951 episode titled Groundhog Day. Enjoy the story.
Shall I go ahead with it? Are you rolling, Ed? Okay, this is Old Tales and New for February 1st, 1954, program called Z.T. Grubney Meets a Groundhog. The number is E285. The Minnesota School of the Air invites you to listen to Old Tales and New. Hi there, boys and girls. Are you all set for another tape-transcribed story? Good. Then sit back, relax, and listen to what happens when Z.T. Grubney meets a groundhog.
You want to know what an emergency is, Bertha Betty Grubney.
Yes.
Is that your question?
Yes, Mr. Mayor. You said this meeting was called because of an emergency. Is an emergency like a flower? I understand flowers.
No, Bertha Betty. An emergency is something that happens like an accident.
Oh.
This morning we have an emergency, and that's why I called all the Grubney fairies together. Quiet now. Quiet, everybody. Quiet, Grubneys. Come to order. As I said, we have an emergency. Very shortly it will be Groundhog Day. Do you all know what a groundhog is?
A groundhog is like a rabbit, only with different ears.
No, Fubney Grubney, a groundhog is nothing like a rabbit. A rabbit eats carrots, and I never saw a groundhog eat a carrot.
I know a carrot wants a bit of rabbit.
Order, please. A groundhog is not a rabbit. A groundhog is like a woodchuck. In fact, you might say it is a woodchuck. It's a rather fattish animal that vacations in the ground all winter in burrows. When a groundhog is standing up and attending to its business, it's about 2 feet long and it has a tail.
Mr. Mayor, I have a question.
Yes, Z.T., what is the question?
It is about groundhogs. When you say a business-like groundhog is 2 feet long, whose feet do you mean?
A very good question, Z.T.
Thank you.
I mean people's feet. These groundhogs, or woodchucks, are about 2 people's feet long. Oh. Now, does everyone understand what a groundhog looks like? Well, that's good. As I said, Groundhog Day is coming, and we...
Mr. Mayor, I have a question.
Another question?
Yeah. Why do the groundhogs have a day? Is there something special about the day? And if so, why are there not days for all animals? And if all the animals all have a day, why cannot we Grubney fairies have a day?
No. Now, Z.T., don't get too upset. This Groundhog Day is really an invention of the people. On that day, each year, groundhogs usually come out of their winter homes and stretch their legs and look around. Now, it seems that groundhogs are pretty shy and nervous, and they're apt to jump at the smallest thing. You might say that they're afraid of their own shadows.
I knew a shadow once that got all wet in the rain and sneezed for 2 weeks, and was it ever funny to see?
Yes, Fubney, I fancy we've all known unusual shadows. But to get back to the groundhogs, if a groundhog sees his shadow, he rushes back into his winter home, and the people think that means that spring won't come for 6 weeks. Do you all understand?
Mr. Mayor, what happens if a groundhog doesn't see his shadow and rush off home?
That's a good question, Bertha Betty. It seems the people think that if the groundhogs stay out of their homes, it would mean that spring had already come.
Word has come to me that one groundhog doesn't intend to return to his home, no matter what he sees. Now, if one groundhog stays out and spring happens in the first part of February, instead of later on when it should happen, well, you can see all the trouble we'd have.
Do we find this groundhog and maybe not let him out of his hole at all?
Oh, that's a very interesting question, ZT. Very interesting indeed, because we don't know which groundhog it is.
Oh, boy.
There are hundreds of groundhogs, and only one of them intends to cause any trouble.
I don't know. What are we going to do, Mr. Mayor? How are we going to locate this one awful groundhog?
Each of you Grubney fairies must be a detective. Each one of you must scout around among all the groundhogs on this one day, find the one that would upset the order of things, and persuade him gently to go back into his hole, at least until the middle of March.
Persuade him, Mr. Mayor? Why can't we tie him up and put him back in his hole?
Oh, no. Fubney. I absolutely forbid violence. Our work is gentle work. We are orderly, peaceful fairies. As the seasons change gradually and gently, we must let our actions be gentle actions.
Couldn't we even push him, Mr. Mayor? Not even a little push?
No, ZT, not even a little push. No. You must persuade him, reason with him, talk to him, but no violence, do you understand?
No.
That's good. Now, I want each of you to get lots of sleep, and be up bright and early on the morning of Groundhog Day. We have pictures of groundhogs at the door for you on your way out. There are not quite enough pictures to go around, but you can always look on with a friend, and in this way know very clearly what animal you are looking for. If there are no other questions, the meeting is adjourned. Zarathustra, did you or did you not get your picture of a groundhog at last week's meeting?
Oh, no, Mr. Mayor. I guess you could say I did not. My name sort of comes at the end of the alphabet, and there weren't any left by the time I got to the door.
So that explains why you had that run-in today with a porcupine.
Yeah, whatever it was, I thought it was a groundhog. I couldn't exactly remember what you said a groundhog looked like, but when I saw that animal coming out of a hole, I thought it was a groundhog, and I went right for it.
Yes, I should say you did, ZT, and the president of the local porcupines just called me up. He was so angry his quills were quivering.
Oh, did I do something wrong?
Wrong, ZT? Wrong? Why, you persuaded that porcupine to back into a hole.
Yeah, I guess I'm a pretty good talker, huh? I just talked to that old porcupine and he backed up as neat as anything right into the hole.
Yes, and now he's stuck.
Huh?
He's lodged in the hole because his quills were rubbed the wrong way.
Oh.
Porcupines must go in frontwards. Why, their president has had to send a rescue team. He says some of the quills have been bent so that they look like curls. Really, ZT, how could you mistake a porcupine for a groundhog?
Well, it wasn't hard, Mayor. It was easy.
Yes, ZT, I suppose it was easy for you. I shall have to explain to the president that it was all a mistake.
Well, is it all right, then, if I go out and look for other groundhogs? I saw one with a really bushy tail as I was coming across the grove, and I
thought... Bushy-tailed animals are squirrels! Here is my personal autographed picture of a groundhog.
Oh, yeah.
Take this with you, and don't you speak to any animal that doesn't look like this. Do you understand, ZT?
Oh, I understand, and I won't persuade any more of those fat ones with the pine needles that stick straight out.
Those are not pine needles. Those are porcupine quills. And if I ever hear of you going near a porcupine again, I'll have you demoted to a tenderfoot. You be careful this time, ZT. Take the picture and try to act like a detective.
I will, Mr. Mayor. I'll be the best detective you've got. Whatever a detective is. Excuse me, I beg your pardon. I wonder if you'd mind turning this way a bit more.
What? What did you say?
I said, would you mind turning this way a bit more so that I can look at you? I'm trying to see if you look like this picture. Now, if the sun has gone down, there isn't much light left. That's not easy to see.
What picture you got there, chum?
This is a picture of a groundhog. This is their day, and I've been looking for a groundhog since early this morning, but I haven't found one.
What you looking for groundhogs for, chum? Let me see that picture.
This is a picture of a groundhog, but you can't see it so good in this light. I kind of hate to return to the office without having seen even one groundhog. That's why I stopped you. Thought you maybe could be a groundhog, but I guess you're not, huh?
Well, of all the ugly pictures I've ever seen, well, I sure am a lot better looking than this one.
This picture isn't any good, huh? You know, maybe that's why I haven't been able to find the right animal. Maybe I've been looking for the wrong thing all day.
Now, I don't know what you've been looking for, chum, but that's about the ugliest beat-up groundhog I've ever seen. Why, you should see the groundhog pictures I've got at my place. Handsome, smiling pictures. Would you like to take a peek at them?
Well, I should be getting back to the office. I think I'm a little late as it is.
Well, boy, you can't go through life thinking groundhogs look like that. Now, it won't take any time. You just come along and I'll show you a couple of pictures of a mighty handsome groundhog, namely me.
Well, maybe it'd be all right if I didn't stay very long. It would help me a lot if I had a good picture to go by. I don't know how I can be a detective unless I know what I'm detecting for.
All right, now, lad, you just come along with me. Now, it sure burns me to think they'd put out a picture like that. Why, I've got pictures taken ever since I was a tot that are better than that. No wonder you couldn't find a groundhog. Probably couldn't find one myself if I was looking for something like that. Mind there, don't trip over that bush.
Oh, yeah.
And my house is just over there. Say, if you're hungry, we might get a little something to chomp on, huh?
That's very nice, I'm sure. I am sort of hungry and I'm tired, too. But I could sleep for hours and hours.
Yeah.
Oh, my.
Seem to be getting a little tired myself.
Oh, yeah.
Went to bed early last fall, so I shouldn't be tired now. Duck your head there, boy.
Okay.
We go down this tunnel, and my burrow is the fourth on the right.
It's even darker in here than outside. How am I ever going to see your pictures so I'll know what a really, truly groundhog looks like?
Well, you see, bud, we don't have any light in here because so many of the others are asleep. And a lot of them are kind of afraid of the light.
That's about the only thing I know about groundhogs. I guess they're afraid of light, too. At least that's what the mayor said, yeah.
Yeah, well, here we are, chum. Don't bump into the bed now.
Look, hey. I guess I bumped into the bed.
Guess you did.
Well, it's a mighty comfortable bed. It's about the most comfortable bed I've ever been on.
That's a comfortable bed. And a big one, too.
Yeah, so it is.
The folks who lived here before I moved in said that their whole family liked this bed.
But I could sleep for days and days and maybe even a whole week.
I found these pictures. Ease over, boy, and I'll perch here on the bed and show them to you.
I gotta look at the pictures.
This one I had taken when I was 2 or 3 years old. Me mother, I was like this. This next one was taken when I was old enough to go out on Groundhog's Day all by myself.
All by yourself,
But don't you think they're pretty good looking?
About the best good looking pictures I've ever seen.
These are all snapshots taken at picnics and chestnut hunts and things like that. No. Here's one I like. Now, this one was taken by my grandmother when I first... Say, Bud, are you listening? Can you hear what I'm saying? He's gone to sleep. Of all things. Well, I'm kind of sleepy myself. Though I'd hoped I wouldn't be since I was going to stay out and break the old groundhog's rule today. But I sure could use another week or so of sleep. Got mighty lonesome after all the other groundhogs went back home. Well, I guess I'll just cuddle down here alongside of his, whatever he is, and catch 40 winks myself.
Quiet from me. Quiet, everyone. I know you're all as happy as I am to see Zarathustra come home.
We are especially happy to see him since we know that he was the Grubney Fairy that found the one groundhog that refused to be afraid of its shadow and return home sensibly. Zarathustra, without using force of any kind, persuaded the groundhog to go back to sleep for 6 weeks. And as his crowning achievement, Zarathustra went to sleep with him for the whole time.
Mr. Mayor, it wasn't exactly like that. You see, he persuaded me, and I didn't mean to go to sleep, but I thought that if I had a little food inside me and had a look at some pictures, and then before I knew it, 6 weeks had gone by, and I woke up, and he woke up, and when we went outside the stretch and I saw him in the daylight, well, I was mighty surprised. He was a groundhog.
Well, Zarathustra, however it happened, you managed to find the right groundhog and keep him in his burrow, and that's the important thing. But I suspect that you're the only Grubney Fairy that would, by accident, do the right thing.
Well, it wasn't much, Mr. Mayor. It wasn't hard at all.
You've been listening to the tape-transcribed story play Z.T. Grubney Meets a Groundhog, written especially for radio by Betty Gerling and produced by Mary Lou Reed. 1 week from today, Old Tales and New will bring you a story play about Abraham Lincoln called A Very Small Tribute.
Now that was definitely a well-written and creatively told story. You are listening to the episode Groundhog Day from Tales Old and New, part of the Minnesota School of the Air. The episode was first heard on Thursday, February 1st, 1951, on the University of Minnesota's KUOM radio station. Next, we're going to hear an episode of Quiz Kids, which contains a brief reference to Groundhog Day. Quiz Kids was a popular quiz series that saw gifted preteen kids competing against university professors. The series ran from June 28, 1940 until July 5, 1953, starting on NBC and concluding on CBS. Today's episode from Sunday, January 29, 1950, is titled, If a Groundhog Sees Lamont Cranston's Shadow. Let the challenge begin.
Alka-Seltzer presents from New York, the Quiz Kids versus five distinguished university professors.
Attention, Quiz Kids and professors, listen closely to today's first question. If the groundhog should see Lamont Cranston next Thursday, what would he do?
Yes, there's the first puzzler from the Alka-Seltzer question box. And do you folks at home know the answer? Well, you'll have time to give it a little thought while the youngsters and the professors here in school answer the roll call. And coming to you from New York City this afternoon, here are the Quiz Kids, their guests, and the chief quizzer himself, Joe Kelly.
Thank you, Durward Kirby, and hello, everyone. Welcome to another competitive question session with the Quiz Kids. And I do mean competitive, for again this afternoon, it's the Quiz Kids versus the professors. You know, friends, several weeks ago, the Quiz Kids matched wits with four professors from the University of Michigan. And here in New York City this afternoon, they're facing five professors from four different universities. And both teams are ready and eager to begin, so let's meet them and get started. So here we go with roll call. A Quiz Kid first, then a professor, and so on until we meet all 10 of you. All right, Joel?
I'm Joel Kupferman. I'm 13 years old, and by now I hope I'm a 2B at Roosevelt High School in Chicago.
Professor Kilcoyne?
I am a professor of English at Brooklyn College, and I'm old enough not to compete with these kids.
Naomi?
I'm Naomi Cooks. I'm 11 years old, and by now I'm an 8B at the Grover Cleveland School of Chicago.
Professor Smith?
I'm professor of philosophy at Barnard College, Columbia University. And as for my age, since I didn't prepare a speech, I guess I'll have to fall back on the truth, 28.
Patrick.
I'm Patrick Owen Common. I'm 12 years old, and I'm an 8A at the Fort Dearborn School in Chicago.
Dean Trincy.
Well, I go to school at Hunter College, or that is, I try to take care of the girls who go to school at Hunter College uptown. As for my age, shall I say, I'm twice 21 and a little over, almost the truth.
Oh, that's cute. Yeah, that's ending. And next we have Rochelle.
I'm Michelle Liebling. I'm 10 years old in the sixth grade at the Gale School, Chicago, Illinois.
Professor Fairchild?
I am Professor Emeritus of Sociology at New York University. And as everybody knows, an emeritus is a college professor who's not afraid of losing his job because he has no job to lose.
Malcolm.
I'm Malcolm Mitchell. I'm 12 years old, and I'm in the 8B at Winthrop Junior High School, Brooklyn.
And Professor Freeman.
I'm a professor of English at Hunter College in New York, and a doctor, one of those doctors, as a friend of mine once said, who can't do nobody no good.
Well, friends, there's our lineup of experts, and here we go. Back to that first question, which was from Mrs. Raymond Alsop of Salinas, California. If the groundhog should see Lamont Cranston next Thursday, what would he do? Well, now let's see. We have two professors' hands up, four quiz kids' hands, and Patrick's hand was first.
Well, first I think I better explain. Lamont Cranston is the comic strip character known as the Shadow.
Yeah, right.
And next week is Groundhog Day, so he'll go back into his hole.
He certainly was, yes, sirree, when he saw his shadow. Well, that's fine. Now then, Mrs. J.M. Smith of Kenmore, New York, has furnished us three or four names that are closely associated, but you are to supply the fourth. The first part consists of Jim Crowley, Elmer Layden, Harry Stuhldreher, and whom? Joel?
Well, those are the four horsemen, and the fourth is Don Miller.
Don Miller is right, absolutely, yes. He won't be doing this next one. Harpo, Groucho, Chico, and Professor Freeman. Oh, his hand comes back down. Professor Smith.
Zeppo, and there was a fifth, Gummo.
Get out. Well, how do you like that? Hey, one for good measure. Nice going, Professor Smith. I was just wondering when you folks were going to get in on this. Yeah. All right, here's the third part. John Tyler, Millard Fillmore, Andrew Johnson, and who is the fourth president who was never elected to that office but merely served out an unexpired term? Pat?
Well, Theodore Roosevelt is the next one in line.
Oh, no, no.
Oh, well, that's...
All right, again, Pat?
The next one?
Well, yeah, uh-huh. And who is the fourth president who was never elected to that office but merely served out an unexpired term? Joel?
Chester Allen Arthur.
Chester Allen Arthur is correct. Nice going, Joel. That's fine. Yes, sirree. And that means that your right answer gives Mrs. J.M. Smith of Kenmore, New York, a Zenith table model radio phonograph. And say, friends, you will want to try for one of these Zenith radio phonographs, too. It's a dandy. The record player has the famous Cobra tone arm with three-way automatic record changer for all types of records, and the fine radio gives a deep, rich tone. Now, this Zenith radio phonograph is always Alka-Seltzer's award when the quiz kids answer your question correctly. But when they miss, listen to this, you have your choice between the Zenith Garfield television set and the large console Zenith radio phonograph combination. The Zenith television set has a new super range chassis to ensure the ultimate in performance, the sensational built-in picture magnet aerial, single knob automatic tuning, the big B-size giant circle screen, and the glare band black tube for clearer pictures. The large Zenith console radio phonograph is a wonderful combination. It plays all types of records and gives you AM and FM radio. So get busy, folks. Send those questions to Quiz Kids, Box Y, Chicago 77, Illinois. All right, here we go with more questions. Now, this question is from Alice Hansen of St. Paul, Minnesota. You are to try to identify these real or fictional people who met under unusual circumstances, and you must get two out of three on this. First, an English officer, while taking a sightseeing trip through India, trespassed in the garden of a Brahmin temple and met the priest's daughter. Malcolm?
I believe that was in Lakmi.
That's right, and what was...
Gerald met Lakmi.
Gerald met Lakmi from the opera by that name... Nice going. Very good, Malcolm. Second part. The first time this next young man meets his girl is when she and her friends plan to go wading while waiting for her father, the Major General. How about that one? Rochelle.
I think that was in the Pirates of Penza.
That's right. And can you give me the name?
Well, I think it was Edith, Mabel, and Isabella were waiting for the major and general.
So, and who? All right, Joel?
Well, the boy's name was Frederick.
Frederick met Mabel. Yes, that's right. Pirates of Penzance. Now, in this last case, a young man paid $35 for a salesman's course, exhibited some paintings, and ended up with a wife. Now, there is a very difficult one. How about that? No hands from either board? No? Do we give up? Well, Mrs. Trinzy, that was your husband. Well, after all, don't you remember?
Oh, dear, didn't you catch her off guard? But good.
Well, I know you have a very busy mind, but would you mind telling us, Dean Trinzy, how did this all happen?
Well, I think he paid more for the course than that.
Oh, you do?
Yes, I do.
How much more would you say?
Well, perhaps I never heard the whole story.
Well, I'll tell you what. We sort of took him over in a corner and asked him about these things, and he told us, and, oh, dear. Well, all right, that was a lot of fun, and that's what we want to have once in a while. Now, that was a very interesting question, and so is this next one. But before we tackle it, let's hear about first aid and Alka-Seltzer.
First aid for acid indigestion. Alka-Seltzer. Friends, on those occasions when you eat too much or too fast or when something you've eaten doesn't agree with you, the result is sometimes acid indigestion. And that's when you want fast, dependable relief. So be wise. Alkalize with Alka-Seltzer. Yes, drink a glass of sparkling Alka-Seltzer and see how quickly its soothing action can settle the upset stomach, how efficiently it acts to reduce gastric hyperacidity. There's nothing quite like Alka-Seltzer. It leaves a clean, fresh taste in the mouth and a mighty welcome feeling in the stomach. We think you'll be amazed at Alka-Seltzer's fast, effective action against the distress of acid indigestion. So try it and see, won't you? Remember, when acid indigestion causes discomfort, first aid is Alka-Seltzer.
Yes, sir. Well, here's our next question, class. For Mrs. Ida Young of Detroit, Michigan, try to identify the following romantic ballads from hearing only a few snatches from each. Now, Arlo with the organ will play them for us. All right, Arlo, let's have number one. Professor Smith has his hand up.
How can I leave thee?
How can I leave thee? That's right, huh? Professor Smith. Could you sing just a little, a little sample?
Oh, yes. How can I leave thee? How can...
I hope that gets us ahead. I think we probably need one.
Oh, well, it definitely does. Yes, sir. Crooner Smith. Oh, that was just fine. And here is number two. Patrick?
Well, she's only a bird in a gilded cage.
That's right, yes. Uh-huh. And can anyone sing a little sample of that? For instance, Professor Fairchild?
Not that one.
Oh, can't you really?
No, give me another one, sir.
Oh, it's an old timer.
I know.
No, you don't remember.
I'd hate to admit how old it is.
Oh! Well, Pat, how about you? Can you give us a little sample?
Well, I think I can. She's only a bird in a gilded cage, a beautiful sight to see. You'd think she'd be happy and free from pain.
Ah, wonderful, Patty. Why, say, we just got singers all over the studio this afternoon. Yeah. Now, here's the last one. Professor Smith.
That Abdul Bulbul Amir?
Yeah.
But that's not the name, is
huh?
that?
You sure? That's right, yeah. Can you sing it?
Oh, I'm afraid not.
I'll sing it for you.
Professor Fairchild.
Oh, the sons of the prophets were warlike and bold and quite unacquainted with fear. But the bravest of all was a man, we are told, named Abdul Bulbul Amir.
Oh, yeah. Well, say, I must confess I've never heard such singing.
No, I'm sure.
Oh, now, don't get me wrong, please. Now, please don't. All right. Here we go with our next question. Just to see how well you keep up with the news, Mrs. Grace Hawkins of Miami, Florida, wants to ask what important happening last week will necessitate the rewriting of a great many science books in order to insert the number 97. Malcolm?
Well, I believe out in California they discovered what they think is an element. A new element.
Yes.
And they're at present undergoing the element, supposedly, is undergoing the test to determine whether it really is an element.
That's right. Absolutely. Well, yes, sir.
Well,
and, by the way, the key man on this, insofar as the element is concerned, is our old friend, Dr. Seaborg. Yes, sir, from the University of Berkeley. Well, now let's see. Harry Collins of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, says he's a great believer in reading mystery stories for relaxation, and he would like to see if you contestants can identify three old favorites from the following quotations. You must try to get two out of three. Here's the first one. The only possible object of this rather fantastic business of the advertisement of the league and the copying of the encyclopedia must be to get this not-over-bright pawnbroker out of the way. Professor Smith?
That's Sherlock Holmes, Conan Doyle, the Red-Headed League.
The Red-Headed League, that's right, Professor Smith, yes. Very good. All right, now we're not through yet. In what detective story would you find this? I'm not taking you up to Batty Thomas, Miss Hillary. She's an unlucky belle. Professor Smith?
That's Dorothy Sayers, the Nine Tailors.
Well, how do you like this, man? Well, now, twins, kids, you're going to have to watch these professors now. That's all there is to it. Here's the last one. The fog has swept in swiftly from the lake. Even against the fire, it seemed now to wrap the two men in a gray and clammy blanket. Pat?
Well, I'd say that was the gold bug.
No. No, but I might say you're a little warm, Pat. Professor Smith?
Wilkie Collins of Moonstone.
No, no. No? You give up? Well, let's see. This mystery was written by Professor Freeman on our board this evening. Professor Freeman, after all, don't you read what you write? That's from the mystery, The Case of the Blind Mouse. Do you remember now?
Don't I still don't remember.
Oh, dear. Well, that was certainly fun. Mrs. Ruth Daves of Croton, New York, wants to try you on this one. If United States senators had characteristics that rhymed with their last names, who would these senators be? For instance, if a certain senator always held still, he would be... Well, this is the example, but I have two hands up already. Pat?
Well, that'd be Lister Hill of Alabama.
Senator Lister Hill. That's the idea. Now then, here we go with the question. Try this. If one senator were a myth, the senator would be Professor Kilcoyne.
Smith?
That's right. Where from, by the way?
New Jersey.
New Jersey is right, Senator H. Alexander Smith, Republican from New Jersey. And... here's part two. If a senator found reason to plead, he would be...
Reed?
Professor Kilcoyne.
Senator
right,
Reed?
But you must hold your hand up before you talk. He's slapping his wrist now.
Right. I'm used to talking without permission.
Yeah, well, that's right, from Kansas, Senator Clyde M. Reed. Now, if this senator is careful when he drives... What did you say, Professor Kilcoyne, without your hand up? Oh, it was Professor Freeman. Meet me in the hall room after the cloakroom. Yeah. All right, Professor Fairchild.
Senator Ives of New York.
That's right. Nice going. That's fine. Now then, we're going to have a few sound effects to help us with this question from Leo J. Burke of Harvey, North Dakota. You ought to keep in mind what the different days of the week were named for and tell what day is suggested by each of the following sounds. You must get two out of three, and here is number one.
Naomi?
Well, that was Thunder, and that would be the god of thunder, Thor, and the day of the week that's named after him is Thursday.
No, now, wait a minute. Wait just a minute. We're just a little bit off the beam. Let's have the sound once more, please, just like... Malcolm.
Well, that sounds like war, and the god of war was Mars, so it might be Tuesday.
No, Pat.
Well, it was Tuesday because the god of war was Chu.
No, wait a minute, Professor Smith.
It's a Wednesday for what? Wotan's day, god of war.
Wotan, god of war. That's right, Professor Smith.
That's correct.
Uh-huh. Well, let's see what we can do with number two. Professor Smith's hand went up so fast he's standing up. All right, Professor Smith.
We can clean up on this one. It's Friday cleaning day.
Why do you say Friday, though?
Vacuum cleaner.
Well, all right, but you have to give me more. You have to give me more. Friday was named for whom? Oh. Naomi.
Well, that would be Freya.
Well, no. No. Joe?
Freya, the goddess of the home.
No, you're wrong. Naomi was closer. It's,
Ricka?
Frigga. That's right. Absolutely right. All right. Here's number three. All right, Professor Fairchild.
That's Thursday from Thor.
That's right, because it was thunder.
That's
absolutely right. It's nice going. Uh-huh. That was a lot of fun. That was a few questions. Now then, you are all allowed to use puns in answering this question from Beatrice Wilson of Washington, D.C. Describe a woman by using terms associated with any collegiate sport. For instance, you could say, always the center of attraction. You get the idea? Mm. All right, collegiate sports now. Describe a woman. Professor Kilcoyne?
He's a regular catcher.
What is that?
Catcher.
Well, all right. Okay, you really had to stoop for that one, though, didn't you? Yes, huh? And let's see.
Rochelle. A private base.
She's always on the ball.
Always on the ball.
Okay, and she's swimming in dresses.
Swimming
That's
in dresses?
That's what I like to be.
Fine, Malcolm?
Well, you could use a term in baseball, a curveball. She's got beautiful curves.
Oh, yes, we could. That's right, huh? And Joel?
Well, you could say she was forward or a far throw from this.
A far throw from this. Well, those were all very, very good. Now then, we'll get going on this next question, students, as soon as we hear from Durward Kirby. So let's have that good advice, Durward.
Right, Joe. Friends, remember, first aid for headache. Alka-Seltzer. Yes, when a headache is making you feel miserable, the first thing to do is to drop one or two Alka-Seltzer tablets into a glass of water, watch it bubble up and dissolve, then drink it. And just see how soon the pain of your headache is relieved. Now, there's a reason why Alka-Seltzer is so fast and effective, and that reason is this. Alka-Seltzer is already dissolved when you drink it, and because it is, its pain-relieving agent, sodium acetyl salicylate, is ready to go right to work. And Alka-Seltzer's effervescent base, that Alka-Seltzer fizz, speeds this pain-relieving action on its way. So remember, when you have a headache, when you want fast, dependable relief from that pain, first aid is Alka-Seltzer. Get Alka-Seltzer at any drugstore in either the 30 or 60-cent package. Never be without it in your home.
Yes, you bet, friends. That is good advice. And here's some more good advice. Be sure and give to the March of Dimes, won't you? Now, here's a tricky little question from Francis Holmes of San Francisco, California. A lot of us may remember that Richard Wagner wrote the operas in the Ring of the Nibelungs, but who wrote the words to all those operas? Rochelle?
Well, that was Richard Wagner.
That's right, he wrote them himself.
Not the words and the music. That's all of the operas, too.
Well, certainly, that's right, that's the answer. Here's one from Miss Lee Lessing of Fayette, Mississippi. The clock on the church tower takes the same time to make three strokes as the town hall clock takes to make two strokes. Now, as I came home, they began to strike the hour at the same instant. The church clock finished striking completely finished, while the town clock had two more strokes to go. Now, what time was it? Joel.
Well, let's see. I think if you let x equal the hour, then you could have three halves. Well, you'd have to discount the first strike, as it's only the pauses that really count. So listen, well, you'd have, twice as much of that, because actually the first one counted. You had three in a row and two, then there'd be one against the last two. So you'd have twice times x minus one minus the two, or that's x minus three, twice times in parentheses x minus three would be equal to x minus one. So you'd have 2x minus 6 equals x minus 1. So that'd be the x equals 5, so it'd be 5 o'clock.
That's right, absolutely, Joel. Good boy. That's right. And as I said, as I came home, it was 5 o'clock in the afternoon, not the morning. Now, here's a quickie from John Messer of Danbury, Connecticut. What war, might you say, began with three apples and ended with one horse? Professor Trinzi.
The Trojan War.
The Trojan War, that's very good. The next one is from Phyllis Colbert of Chicago, Illinois. Name two baseball players who had the same last names as two United States presidents. Two baseball players who had the same last names as two United States presidents. Joel?
Well, there's a player on the Pacific Coast, I think he won the batting championship there, that has the last name Wilson.
Wilson?
And there was President Wilson.
That's right. Can't you think of another Wilson, very famous Wilson bygone days?
Hack
Joel?
Wilson.
Hack Wilson, that's right. All right, how about the other one now? Can we think of another one? Professor Freeman.
What about Walter Johnson?
And the president's name?
The president's name was also Johnson.
Well, I was just double-checking. I thought I might possibly catch you off base on that. But I didn't. Yes, sir. Mr. H.G. Hofcroft of Seattle, Washington, asked this question. If you climb these biblical mountains, what important event that once took place there might you reconstruct in your imagination? And first is Mount Sinai. Pat?
Well, Moses got the Ten Commandments there.
That's right, Patty, that's right. How about Mount Ararat? All right, Professor Smith.
The Ark rested on Mount Ararat.
That's right. And how about the Mount of Olives? The Mount of Olives, Pat?
Well, that's when Jesus went to pray for the last time. That's known.
That's right. That's correct, yes. Patty. Yes. This question is from Catherine Hudson of New York City. When most good ball players walk out on the field, you hear a lot of O's and ah's and gollies and G's from their fans. But what player gets 100 G's for walking out on the field? Professor Fairchild.
DiMaggio.
Joe DiMaggio. $100,000. Now then, you'll need plenty of imagination for this question from Mrs. R. Hogan of River Forest, Illinois. If you were buying a garment of clothing for the following people and chose garments that were appropriate according to the name of each person, let's see what you could purchase. For instance, you might buy a racketeer a slicker. You get the idea? All right. Now here's the question. What might you buy a girl paratrooper? A garment of clothing, Professor Freeman.
Jumpers.
A jumper, yes. And what might you buy for a painter? Real quick. A painter. Remember, a garment of clothing. Joel.
Well, something that I just brushed by.
Well, yes, but what else now? What do they put on a house first? I mean, all right, Naomi.
A coat.
A coat, that's it. Good girl, yes. Well, say, that old school bell means our question session is over, class. The next puzzle is for the judges. Which team won, the professors or the quiz kids? We'll have the answer for you in just a minute, but first, here's an important message for our listeners.
Don't take chances. Are you giving your family the protection of one-a-day brand multiple vitamin capsules for these winter months? You buy winter coats and warm clothing as insurance against winter's colds and snows. But by all means, remember your wintertime vitamin insurance, too. Make mealtime your vitamin time.
Put that one-a-day brand multiple vitamin bottle on the table and make sure everyone in your family takes one-a-day brand multiple vitamins. 60 capsules, 2 months supply, only $2. Ask your druggist for one-a-day brand multiple vitamin capsules.
All right, well, here's the answer. The judges report that as a class, you didn't miss any questions this afternoon. The score for our team of professors is 88, and the quiz kids, 92.
Well,
congratulations, quiz kids, and congratulations to you professors, too. You really put up a good fight. Yes, it's been another great session in radio's famous Classroom the Air. It was a privilege to have you professors with us this afternoon, and we want to thank you for participating so splendidly. And for each of you professors, we have a Zenith table model combination radio phonograph, and we hope you like it. Now, next Sunday, we'll be back home in our Chicago classroom with quiz kids Ruthie Duskin, Rennie Templeton, Lonnie Lundy, Harvey Deitch, and Patrick Conlon. We hope to mark all you listeners present in school, too, so plan to be with us, won't you? That's next Sunday, same time, same station. And until then, this is Joe Kelly dismissing class. Goodbye, kids.
Bye.
Goodbye, Professor.
Goodbye.
Don't forget to do your share for the March of Dimes and do it today. Listen to the Quiz Kids every week and see and hear Alka-Seltzer's Quiz Kids television show over NBC every Friday night. Consult your local newspaper for time and station. This is Durwood Kirby speaking.
Wow, what an episode. It's not every day you see children outsmarting professors, but that's definitely what happened in this last episode. You are listening to the Quiz Kids episode, If a Groundhog Sees Lamont Cranston's Shadow, from Sunday, January 29, 1950, on NBC. The main university the kids competed against was the University of Chicago, and according to John Dunning, over the course of the series, the Quiz Kids trounced Chicago's educators by a score of 275-140, a remarkable achievement. We're going to end today's program with an episode of Tarzan, the radio series based on the novel Tarzan of the Apes by Edgar Rice Burroughs, ran from 1932 to 1936 in transcribed syndication, and then again from 1950 to 51, also in syndication. Today's episode dates to Monday, September 19, 1932, and stars James Pierce as Tarzan. The episode is titled Tarzan Rescues the Captain and has surprisingly good audio for its vintage.
Tarzan of the Apes, brought to you out the pages of Edgar Rice Burroughs' famous book. Tarzan lies unconscious on the ground. Sabor sees a lithe, hairless body inert and motionless before her. Crouching, snarling, her lean haunches gather beneath her, her back arches with a spring, her jaws gaping to reveal her yellow fangs. Merciless hatred for the thing which lies so helpless in front of her gleams from her baleful, yellowish eyes. Poised, tense, crouched for the leap, the lioness waits for some movement, some motion which will send her hurling upon her victim. There is a moment of silence, a tense moment, a moment in which furious death waits to execute its grim mission. Poised, waiting. Slowly, Sabor's animal brain connects the presence of her cub with Tarzan. Histor was devouring the cub. Tarzan fought Histor. The cub is safe. Slowly, suspiciously, the great beast relaxes. The hair on her short mane gradually lies down, and her tensed haunches straighten. Slowly, very slowly, she advances toward Tarzan's limp body. Snarling deep in her throat, she stops, showing this strange creature lying so still before her the deference of fear. Cautious, ever ready to crush the life out of the thing with a mighty paw should it move, she advances closer and closer, step by step. Her sharp, pungent breath is hot on Tarzan's neck. Sabor sniffs. The thing has a strange scent. Not the scent of an ape. Sabor is puzzled. Tarzan stirs. Moans a little in his unconsciousness. Sabor leaps back, snarling, her powerful paw raised to crush the head of that strange creature. Slowly, she puts her foot back on the ground, circles Tarzan, and without further ado, trots away, urging her cubs before her. Sabor, the merciless killer, the feared, the dreaded, Sabor the beast, has learned gratitude. Tarzan lies unconscious. The fall would have been sufficient to kill an ordinary man, but Tarzan breathes. The jungle sun sinks lower and lower. Suddenly there is no day. A dank, steaming mist arises from the ground and drifts in great clouds through the forest, like ghosts of massive monsters returned from some primitive jungle of eons before. Tarzan still does not move. He lies easy prey to the savage beasts of the jungle, the deadly insects, the sleeping leopard, the murderous gorillas, and worst of all, the snake, Histah, the silent, cold, crushing, slithering death. The moon comes up, making the jungle a wilderness of tall shadows, growing in a myriad of puddles of moonlight. The jungle becomes replete with sound, the whimpering cry of the lemurs, the weird laughter of the hyenas at the waterhole, the roar of Numa, the lion, walking in imperial disdain, heralding his approach to the waterhole. A cold, dead weight is slowly coiling itself around Tarzan's body. Its heavy, gliding pressure stirs him. With a growl of anger, Tarzan regains consciousness. The small steamer, bearing our passengers and the mutinous crew, steams down the golden path laid by the moon off the sea on the West African coast. The same moon which shines down upon the inner Tarzan, his cousin Clayton could see if he chose to look through a porthole of the ship's salon. How closely related, and yet how far removed these two. Tarzan the Ape Man and William Cecil Clayton. The four in the salon, Jane and Professor Porter, Clayton and the captain, discovered that they're locked in. The crew is mutinied. Newton, the seaman, has informed the captain. Newton leaves. A scream is heard. It's his. Grabbing the two automatics, the captain and Clayton rush to the door. It's locked.
We're pawned in.
No, what are they doing to that poor man?
There, there, dear. Everything will be all right.
I'm afraid it won't be all right. This is mutiny. We can't stand here and let them torture that man this way. Open the door. Open it, you hear that? I won't stop it. I can't stand here and listen to that. I'm going to try and shoot the latch off the door. Clayton. We'll do nothing of the sort. I'm captain here, and as long as I am captain, I'll be obeyed. Understand that? We've a devilish grave situation. This is mutiny. If I can get them to open that door of their own will, we have a chance. If I can't, we're better off in here.
I'd suggest, Mr. Clayton, that you leave the matter entirely in the captain's hands.
Sorry, Captain. Not at all. Miss Porter.
Yes, Captain.
You will find in the top drawer of my desk a small jade green bottle. Its contents are deadly. I hope it proves to be a souvenir of an unsuccessful mutiny.
You don't think, Captain, that it would be necessary?
This crew is the scum of Port Said. And Port Said, my dear Clayton, well, you've seen it.
I found the bottle, Captain. Thank you.
Isn't there some way that we can placate these mutineers, Captain? If it's money, why, I have a little...
And I have a great deal. See if you can buy them off. If they take the ship, everything on it is theirs anyway. Yaunt, my first mate, is in back of this, and Yaunt is no fool.
Rather an intelligent fellow, in fact. I've had several conversations with him. Seems rather interested in archaeology.
You'll stand away from the door, Miss Porter. Thank you. Mr. Yaunt! Mr. Yaunt, do you hear me? Yaunt!
Yeah, I heard you, Captain.
Come here and unlock this door.
And get shut down. Oh, thank you, Captain. Throw those two automatics. They're in your desk out the port first.
Are you presuming to order me, Mr. Yaunt? You'll lose your papers for this.
My papers? You're on the high seas now, Skipper. Not at the Admiralty. My papers? They've been changed, Tracy. They're captain's papers now.
You are mad. This is mutiny. You realize what that means?
Yes, and you'd better realize, too. Throw up those automatics on the deck. I'm not asking you. I'm telling you.
And I'm telling you, Mr. Yaunt, that I'll see this ship run aground in Hades before I'll take orders from you.
Yeah? Well, we'll twist the bloody arms off of your nosy man, Newton, here, and throw him over the side. If those guns aren't thrown out on the deck in exactly 1 minute.
Oh! Throw him out, sir! Throw him out, please! Just throw him out!
Oh, Captain, throw them out, please! Please, please, throw them out!
There goes mine.
All right. Now, where's the other one?
Well, I guess they've got us there. You take the clip out of that automatic before you chucked it out, Clayton?
No, no, I didn't.
Not very clever of you. Well, here goes.
You're learning to take orders readily, Captain.
Come in here.
Oh, I just happened to think. Quick, Father, give me that map.
Why, yes. Where did I... why, here it is.
Daniel, you and Gates watch this door. If either the ex-captain or any of his passengers start to need
I saw it.
Well, Tracy, it seems...
You dirty cat, you.
Shut up, Clayton.
I won't shut up. What?
You killed Clayton.
Stand back there, all of you, or I'll start blasting. That's just to show you how this ship is going to be run from now on. Only next time, I'll use the business end and not the butt of the gun.
I wouldn't be surprised if you'd killed him, Yonks.
It doesn't make a great deal of difference, Tracy.
Not to you, it doesn't. They hang them just as high for mutiny as they do for murder.
Not when there aren't any witnesses.
You don't mean...
That there won't be any witnesses? Yes.
Tarzan regains consciousness. A sinewy thing of all muscle is wrapping itself around him, slowly encircling him. He voices the ferocious cry of a battling beast. The contracting length wound around him tightens. Tarzan struggles. Then suddenly he feels himself lifted high in the air. Another moment, and he finds himself safe on the broad back of Tantor the elephant. Tantor, his friend. Despite his aching head, Tarzan gives a bawl of triumph. Tantor, the great beast of the jungle, whom even Sabor fears, hears the call of his friend. The wise beast knows that all is well with the white ape upon his back. Tantor is happy too, for Tarzan is dearer to Tantor than all else in the world. A strange jungle friendship, as strong as it is odd. Tantor throws back his great trunk and trumpets to tell the fastest of the whole forest and its denizens that the mighty Tantor and his friend Tarzan are passing on their way. Let all beware. Tarzan feels himself all over gingerly and then shrugs. Nearness to death is life, not adventure in the jungle. Guiding Tantor by kicking him behind the ear, Tarzan directs the great beast to the seashore and his cabin. Tantor sways along his way at a speed which is almost unbelievable for so clumsy an appearance, tearing up the trees and brush which impede his way. Then Tarzan hears the beating of the surf, and in a few minutes they come out of the jungle onto the beach. A strip of white sand, a sea of darkness divided by golden bands. Tarzan looks down the path of the moon on the water. He gasps. A boat. That means men. Tarzan the ape thrills because he sees in them that which he most wants to be. Man. Tarzan the man.
Well, Tarzan saves the day once again. You were listening to the episode Tarzan Rescues the Captain, which first aired on September 19, 1932 in transcribed syndication. The audio quality did start to suffer later in the episode, but given the age of this program, it is still quite good. Well, that's just about it for me today, I'm afraid. But I'll be back next week, and I hope you'll join me then. I'd love to hear from you. You may email me at opr@telus.net, or write to me at Old Parlor Radio, 2880 15th Avenue, Prince George, B.C., Canada, Victor 2 Mike, 1 Tango 1. May the groundhog by your place see no shadows so you will have an early spring. From the CFIS studios in Prince George, I'm Corey Walker. Have a great week and happy Groundhog Day.